My name is Gianni Russo, a.k.a. Carlo, the infamous son-in-law from The Godfather. I'm now known as the Hollywood Godfather, and this is my story.
Before all of the wins in my portfolio, I was a little boy diagnosed with polio. Experimenting with cures, I tried every one. Felt everything in my right, but my left was numb. Walking with a limp, like will I ever run? Once again, or is this it? Am I forever done? Living in the hospital was never fun. Some people were cool, but not everyone.
Good evening, everyone. It's time for another Hollywood Godfather podcast. And tonight, I'm really excited to introduce a special guest. And I'll do that right after we introduce the lady, the only lady on the show. Thank God we have one. Jeannie Raymond, my darling, how are you tonight?
Hello, I'm so happy to be here. It's my favorite day of the week. Get to hang out with my pals, so.
Here we go. And our co-host, the Hollywood Kid. I can't believe this, Michael.
Hey, Johnny.
Hollywood Kid.
I'm the
Hollywood Godfather. You couldn't write this stuff.
You couldn't make this up. You couldn't do it. I mean,
well, I got a guy that knows how to write.
And he couldn't come up with this.
many books. And what's more interesting, what I want to get into tonight, that I know he just turned in the Gambino book.
Wow.
And the Gambinos, as you know, I didn't even know who the guy was. I knew he was my uncle. Then I found out it really wasn't my uncle. But he'd sent me a transistor radio in the polio ward when I was turning 7 years of age. And he told his niece, the radio fell off the truck. I didn't figure that out until later on in life. with nothing else to say, Michael Benson, my friend, how are you?
Hello, Johnny. Thanks for having me.
No, please. But we're excited for a lot of reasons we can't talk about. But
that's true. Well, there has been a lot of talk about you and I.
I know.
A lot of talk.
Which is all good.
Yes, yes.
So
we can't really say too much, though.
No, but what we're talking about, how we normally run the show, Michael, is that Jeannie takes on the persona of the audience that's listening.
Okay.
She's any questions that she thinks they may have, she's going to jump in. Mike has history on you himself. I mean, Mike, now we got two Michaels. The Hollywood Kid, he knows more about you than I do. But I know one thing. You and I have a big future together. So let's get into the show itself. And can you tell us a little about, now that you turned the book in, the Gambino?
Well, I think that
you're so different.
Well, the Gambino book is from the point of view of my co-author, Frank DiMatteo. Now, Frank is the son of Rick DiMatteo, who was Larry Gallo's bodyguard. And then after Larry passed away, became a trusted member of Joey Gallo's gang on President Street in Brooklyn. So there are large sections which are Frank telling about the three times he encountered, you know, Don Carlo during his life and how that affected him. And in one case, Gambino saved his life by calling off Neil Del Croce, who wanted to, you know, take care of him because of a problem he'd had in a bar. Got into a fight with one of Neil's guys, but Gambino liked him. He'd met him when he was a kid, and said, "Go easy on him." And so he's still around. He's out. He has gone legit. He's got a beautiful family in Brooklyn, and he's my pal. We're about the same age, same sick sense of humor, he and I have now talked. We've written about Gambino. We've written about Carmine Galante. Written about Carmine Persico. We have three Carmines. And Carmine DiBiase, a.k.a. Sonny Pinto, the guy who actually shot Joey Gallo. Sorry, it wasn't the Irishman.
Well, that Irishman thinks he was everywhere.
Yeah.
You know what's so funny when you say that? They just left me at the Copacabana. It was Joe Gallo's birthday.
Yes. Rickles was performing, right?
Wow. Yep. This is a funny story. So now they were with the actor. Oh, he's a great actor. His friend was an actor in New York.
Law and Order? What was his name?
Lauren Orbeck.
Orbeck.
Jerry Orbeck.
It was Jerry Orbeck and his wife, Joe and his wife. They're watching Rickles. The show's over. I'm sitting with them all, and which is very funny because that same night, you won't believe who was in the club. Sonny Francesi. I mean, that went, you know, when you go to the Copacabana, I mean, there was so many legitimate people like Walter Winchell, along, you know, and you name them. Plus, you know, the society in New York. And then in front of them sitting is the mob because they'd carry tables in for these guys. So they leave and I'm just a kid. And they said, we're going to go down to Chinatown. They used to go to 14 Mott. I don't know if you know the story, Michael.
I do.
They go to 14 Mott and it's closed. They sterilized it or something. So Orbeck says, well, let's go to Umberto's. Not realizing Joe Gallo couldn't go to Umberto's. So they weren't going to say anything. And they went to Fordham, sat down, had dinner, and your friend, Michael, walks by and sees him.
Yeah.
And he goes and gets permission. He goes to the club. And he says, you won't believe he's in the neighborhood. And I guess he was trying to make his bones. I don't know him that well.
Oh, no. DiBiase had been around. The name of the book is Mafia Hitman. He was well-suited for the job. And he got the job done.
No, but what I'm saying, though,
he wasn't making his bones.
Oh, no, I didn't know. So again, I'm a kid. I was like 16 or 17.
That was an established guy. wasn't a big guy, but he was a little Italy guy, and knew his way around Mulberry Street. So he knew which door to go in.
Oh yeah,
he went in the side door and out the side door. And Joey Wounded tried to get away from the women. He was not only with his wife but with his stepdaughter. And he tried to get away from them as fast as possible. And he managed to get outside and died in the middle of the street.
Right. I mean, these are stories you couldn't make them up. I mean, as good as a writer as you are, we could try. But the thing is that real life in the mob, when you get into it, is like insanity. And how they got away with it then. And it was a different time then, too. I mean, today, you got so many stool pigeons and rats around. Forget about it.
That's Rico. Rico did
Rico
his job.
Destroyed everybody.
Yeah.
They all got YouTube channels now.
Well, yeah, I know. I can't believe it. So tell us more about that guy.
Well, you know what? I'd really rather talk about gangsters versus Nazis.
Yeah. Okay.
Because it's been out for almost 2 years, and it's still my bestseller. It's a book about 1938 in America, Great Depression. Everybody had no money for almost a decade, and the German-American Bund was on the rise in America. They were having parades in Manhattan, just like the Macy's Thanksgiving parade, only with goose stepping and Sieg Heiling. And a fellow named Judge Nathan Perlman, he got fed up, and he decided to do something. And he, after over a cocktail, he decided what these guys needed was a good punch in the nose. So he calls his pal Meyer Lansky, and they don't know each other because one's a judge and one's a crook. They know each other because one's an ex bootlegger and one's a drinker. And Lansky and Perlman get together, and along with Longy Zwillman in Newark, Mo Dalitz, Mickey Cohen, and Bugsy Siegel out in L.A. And every time
that's
the German American
Mo went out to Vegas too.
Yeah, and oh, you know, yeah, and I think he's still in Cleveland at that time.
Yeah.
And every time the German American Bund would try to have a meeting or a recruiting meeting, these guys would come in and bust the place up, put as many of them in an emergency room as they could, but no one was ever killed. When Perlman went to Lansky, he brought along with him Rabbi Stephen Wise, who, and of course, World War II hadn't happened yet. So to start killing German-American Bund members would have shut down the whole thing right away. The police would have had to do something about it, and the Jews would have looked bad. But by just beating them up, what they did is they stifled the movement. They shut these guys up and held the Nazi movement down until Pearl Harbor started World War II, and all those guys who were executing their First Amendment rights were now committing sedition. But it's a little corner of American history I don't think a lot of people know about. And today, in the last year or so, it has become really, really relevant. I mean, it's probably the first instance in American history where Jews showed they could be tough.
You know, Michael, when you talk about, we hear the word gangsters and mobsters, people automatically think about mayhem, murder, cars blowing up. But like you say, I mean, the gangsters, it's sort of like a Dirty Dozen type of deal, where it's like they played a vital role in stomping out Nazism in America.
I love the Dirty Dozen reference. Thank you so much, because people have come at me with the morality of my book. Your good guys are crooks and they're breaking the law. Your bad guys are breaking no laws. The whole book takes place in the gray area between what is legal and what is just. Well, I say, hey, look at the Dirty Dozen. These are the worst 12 guys they could find. They're all going to be executed, but they're the heroes of the story. And why? They're fighting Nazis.
Right.
The heroes in Gangsters versus Nazis are bad men before the book. They're bad men after the book. Some of them are executed. But during the book, they're great men doing great things. And they're doing their patriotic duty. They're not only fighting for their people, for the Jewish people, they're fighting for America and the American way.
In the Jewish mob back then, correct me if I'm wrong, I mean, we're talking early 20th century, the early 30s, Al Capone's of the world, Frank Costello's of the world, Lucky Luciano's of the world. But the Jewish mafia had a seat at the table as well.
Well, that's because, Lansky and Lucky Luciano were childhood friends, well, teenage friends. They met on a street corner, and I think Luciano tried to shake Lansky down, and Lansky stood up to him, and they partnered up. And the partnership between the Italians and the Jews stemmed completely from that relationship. Al Capone
And it goes on still.
Did Meyer Lansky hold somebody out a window? Am I wrong?
He dropped him.
Oh, he dropped him.
He dropped it. It's the closest we come to breaking the no-kill rule. And Lansky himself, apparently there's one really loud-mouthed guy at the Yorkville Casino, the venue where they're busting up the place. And he and another gangster hold this guy out the window by the leg. Should we? Yeah, okay. And they drop him. Now, if the guy had landed on his head like he probably should have, he would have died. But he flips over in the air, lands on his legs, and breaks his femur. Also, Lansky exaggerated. He said, we threw some guys out the window. There was only one guy. It was only one guy. I could tell by the hospital reports. Only one guy went out that window.
He's like a Valachi.
I mean, I had the privilege early on when I started working for Costello, and the second most important person I met with Costello was Meyer Lansky at the Waldorf. I mean, they were very instrumental in so many world-changing things, even in the late 50s, early 60s. They got John F. Kennedy nominated Democratic president because of Joe. And they were all partners with Joe during Prohibition.
Right. That's right.
So, I mean, that whole conspiracy was insane. And I remember well going under the Verrazano Bridge on November 22nd, not knowing why I was told to leave the country. Mm. And next thing I heard, the president was shot, not dead yet.
Right.
And all the pilot boats were coming. Every executive that was on there from Wall Street, they were all leaving. And me, with my mentality at the age I was, I said, look at this, there's all women on the ship now. I have a party here.
Well, as perhaps you know, I wrote a book called Who's Who in the JFK Assassination. I looked it up. You're not in there, Jenny.
No, I know. Thank God. No.
Only Perry Raymond Russo was one of the part of the Garrison case.
Was he in the Warren Report? Was he in the Warren Report or no?
No. You know why I wasn't? Because when I first went out after Joe Kennedy left the Waldorf and made the deal with Costello, I was never privy to anything, and he did that deliberately. And I think I said the story once before. When I went to Chicago first to meet a major guy, he gave me an envelope And so when you get there, someone's going to pick you up at O'Hare and bring you to the hotel. And then he's going to take you to a hotel. I get there, and the guy asked me for, did he give you an envelope? I gave him the envelope. And he took it out. I knew it was, $10,000. And two signatures of sign. So he said, do you know what this is? I said, no. I signed it. He signed it. And he said, now we're client privilege. I'm your attorney. Sidney Korshak.
Jimmy Hoffa.
That's how they protected me.
He was Hoffa's attorney too, wasn't he?
Yeah. Oh, well, later on, yeah. No, I mean, he became Steve Wynn's attorney. He was Mr. Fix-It after the years go by. But that's why, and all everybody knew me as the kid, and nobody knew how you're going to find. That's why they use a lot of nicknames, but I was always the kid. Nobody knew who the hell the guy was. And then I left for 22 months while that whole Warren thing was going on. But it's.
I'm not sure how much the FBI was going to investigate anyway. I think J. Edgar Hoover was anxious to
figure out what.
No.
I mean, the CIA was a part of that whole situation. Let me see if I get the guy's name right. When John F. Kennedy, as the president, fired Paul Doolin, was it the head of the CIA?
Oh, it was Alan Dulles.
Alan Dulles. He fires the guy. That was it. They wanted to kill him right for that alone. The deal, as I overheard it later on, LBJ, the only reason he came in as vice president, they promised him the next 8 years. He hated the Kennedys. So, there was no way John was leaving Texas that day.
Well, no.
Between the Texas Rangers, the CIA, the mob, and the one guy I spoke to years later before they killed him was Johnny Roselli. Johnny Roselli was in Elm Avenue.
Yes, yeah, the Nightmare on Elm Street, right?
Yeah, hello.
Crazy.
So that book is out 2 years already?
Yeah, Gangsters versus Nazis out for 2 years. And to no one's surprise, Jewish people really, really like the book. It's a book Jewish men fight Nazis, and they win every single time. I've been doing the synagogue tour. I'm a good Catholic boy, but I'm doing the synagogue tour. I've talked to a lot of Jewish groups. I did a Zoom with the American Jewish University a couple weeks ago. 1,500 people watched. And wow. one of them was Nat Arno's son. Nat Arno was the captain of the Nazi fighters in Newark. He was Longy Zwillman's right hand man.
Michael,
that's got to be. I never even heard about the book. I got to get it and read it. But because I was around, as many as Italians I was around Jews. I mean, my best friend, and you'll know the guy's name. And we've been friends for 60-something years. Al Malnick. Al Malnick, forget this guy yet. You know, Michael. This guy was, and still a major, major guy. He's 91. I always tell him, I'll always be 10 years younger than you.
Go ahead, Jeannie. Your turn.
I just was wondering where you, Gianni, and where you guys met.
We met last week.
Oh, we had a meeting last week.
That we really can't
talk about.
Okay.
The good news about it, though, I think we can say we're in collaboration on something that's very big. Huge.
Yes.
Huge for me.
It's an exciting thing, but his people have to talk to my people. And
we're doing
business.
There's
some
papers to be signed.
I just write. I don't know how the business works.
That's how we met. We met over lunch a week ago.
Yeah.
And I feel like I know Michael. But, again, not knowing all the books you wrote. My audience knows it. I'm an illiterate, so when I have to read a book, someone has to read it to me.
I think Gary gave you a copy of Gangsters versus Nazis. So it's probably in a stack of books someplace in your pad.
No, I have it. No, I'm just waiting for a girl to read them to me.
Okay. That's,
I don't like guys talking to me.
I, sorry,
spending
I don't
that much time in my house to begin with.
Okay. Fair enough.
Michael, yes. this Bund, how do you pronounce it? The Bund Group?
You can say Bund. It's Bund, B-U-N-D.
No. Correct me if I'm wrong. Did they rent out Madison Square Garden for a rally?
They did. And that's at the very end of the book. They had had their meetings smashed across the country. And their leader decides to take one last gasp. And he gets around Mayor LaGuardia's anti-Nazi rules. He books Madison Square Garden for a pro-America rally. It's always pro-America. There's always an American flag next to the swastika flag. There's always a picture of George Washington next to Hitler. You know, equate the two in your mind. And Fritz Kuhn, the leader of the Bund, he is psyched because he knows this is good. Finally, he's going to get his big headlines in the New York papers about what a great thing, you know, the Nazi movement is. And what happens is very different because a single unemployed Jewish plumber sneaks into the garden. And while Fritz Kuhn is giving his speech, he runs up on the stage, pulls the plug on him, and then turns to the crowd and says, "Hitler's got one ball." And his ground troop, the stormtroopers pounce on him and they pull down his pants. Now, big laugh from the Nazi crowd. But he's only in distress for maybe 10, 15 seconds when the New York cops come and grab him, get him outside. And there's a picture of him in the grasp of the New York cops looking like he's still in distress with his pants down, but he is being rescued. They take him to jail. And the next morning, he's in court, and the courtroom is packed with Jewish men, all of whom want to be the one to pay his bail.
Wow.
The headlines that Fritz Kuhn wanted weren't there. Instead, Izzy Greenbaum steals the show.
That boy, Izzy.
Yeah.
But, you know, you talk about Izzy Greenbaum, the Jewish people, they knew what was going, what they were hearing from you know, what's going on in Germany. You know what I mean?
That's right.
They had spies everywhere, yeah.
That's right, but Gentiles kind of didn't. Gentiles really, in the Nazis versus Jewish philosophies, felt like they didn't have a dog in the fight. But the Jewish people were getting letters from Europe saying, you know, Uncle Moishe disappeared last week. I don't think he's coming back. So there's this notion that this hate speech coming out of the American Nazi groups is leading to, you know, genocide. I mean, they're already talking about the cancer that is Jewish people. We need to cut it out, save America. I don't feel any moral problem with punching these guys in the nose, no.
I mean, you're talking newsreels, telegraphs, you know, obviously with the technology back then. I don't think Hitler was too happy that the Germans bombed Pearl Harbor.
No, absolutely not. He did not want America to come into the war. But the city he wanted to control most is in your backdrop. He wanted LA. He wanted Hollywood, the world's number one propaganda machine. His theory was that if he could take over the studios and crank out anti-British and anti-Russian movies, he might be able to win the hearts and minds of America without firing a shot. But yeah, Pearl Harbor blew that idea out of the water.
I think he was sadly mistaken that the Jews ran Hollywood.
He thought that there was enough old money in Los Angeles, oil money, which is really only a generation older, that he would be able to find allies in that group, anti-Semites, who would help him take over the studios. He was really shocked.
Take a break a minute. We got to make some money. We'll be right back. I'm going to do this commercial myself because it's the last time I can say it. PaisanCon. April 13th and 14th, Fairfield, New Jersey. Make your reservations. Look it up. Go on the website, PaisanCon. It's the first time, like we're talking today, about the Germans and the Jews organizing. The Italians are finally getting a con, Comic-Con, Thrill-Con. I bet every con there was. Come to PaisanCon, April 13th and 14th. All right, we're back. With two mics and a beautiful genie.
One more, if I get another question in, like,
sure.
Tell our audience what Hitler wanted to do to Charlie Chaplin.
Oh, well, The idea was he was going to kidnap the Jewish moguls and the top Jewish stars, and he was going to hang them publicly. I don't know how you're winning hearts and minds of Americans with this kind of thinking. Yeah, you know, he didn't understand America in several. He certainly didn't understand L.A. He said, "Where's the German section of town?" No, there is no German section of town. Everybody here is new.
They didn't even have a German deli there.
No. So he builds his own German section. It's kind of sort of a complex called the Aryan Bookstore. And it's got a restaurant. And if you have, I think Walt Disney went there and Gary Cooper and a couple of other right-leaning people. But he obviously failed miserably in L.A. And by the time Mickey Cohen and Bugsy Siegel start punching these guys, they'd had enough.
You get hit by Mickey Cohen.
Yeah.
You got hit.
He won his first boxing tournament when he was 10.
Yep.
They used to have boxing tournaments for kids, for newsies. Like they would, and grown men would sit around and bet. It strikes me as
I know. And you know, I, Michael, you don't know this. My audience has heard this before. I had to go tell Mickey Cohen that his daughter was pregnant.
No, you did tell me that story. That's a scary moment.
Hello.
I love the punchline. Didn't he say, don't marry her? Is that the one?
Yeah. She was so spoiled. And he said it. I mean, can't believe it. And our son now is, 56? And he goes still to synagogue yet, and his name is Gianni Russo Jr. They cannot translate it in Hebrew. His mother wanted a Gianni Russo Jr. It's my second one. It's so funny.
Crazy. So tell us some titles of a few more of your books.
Okay. I wrote Killer Twins. I started out as a sports writer. I edited a magazine called Fight Game, which is about boxing, which is one of the reasons I think Gangsters versus Nazis is entertaining. I could tell a good fight. I wrote the Ballparks of North America. It's an encyclopedia of every baseball park going back to the Civil War. I wrote, Change of Pace, Why the Grateful Dead Matter. I got that job, and I was starting to get a little worn down by true crime. When I was writing about psycho killers with innocent victims, it wore on me for a while. I needed an emotional break from all that. So Why the Grateful Dead Matter was great. It gave me an opportunity to let my hair down, so to speak, and to think about things where nobody was hurting anybody. Just sort of listen to Jerry Garcia for a while and write about it. it was so much fun. I judged a Jerry Garcia lookalike contest. I went to Jerry Con. I was at Garcia's multiple times. I was the warm-up act for the band. I went up there. I did top 10 reasons why the Grateful Dead matter. It got to number one. And the number one reason why the Grateful Dead matter is Jerry Garcia, man.
That's wild.
Michael, I want to circle back to your early childhood, if I can. Being a, you know, obviously you're an investigative writer, you got to really dig deep. I mean, sadly, you had some experience with that at a young age.
Yes. When I was 9 years old, I lived at the end of a dirt road in a rural section south of Rochester, New York. The big field behind my house.
Must have been really rural. Rochester is pretty rural in itself.
Well, Rochester is a city, but we weren't in Rochester. My babysitter and her friend Kathy went swimming in a swimming hole behind my house and didn't come back. They were found a month later on the other side of my dad's property.
Oh, wow.
Horribly mutilated, like a Jack the Ripper type crime. That turned me into a writer. About age 11, I started writing in a diary about it. I worked on it every year until 43 years later, I published The Devil at Genesee Junction. What happened was I did a couple of true crime books, decided I knew how to investigate a crime. I went back to my hometown, teamed up with the mom of one of the victims who was still alive, who was a friend of my mom. and a private detective, and we figured out what happened in my backfield when I was nine. And the book's called The Devil at Genesee Junction. And you know, you may understand a little bit about this, Gianni. I took a trauma from my childhood, and I externalized it and made it a positive thing. And I was later given awards because I had helped heal the community. And I said, honestly, take my word for it. I was only thinking about healing myself.
Right. And
everything else is a bonus.
To go through that. Yeah, man. See, you have to, as you're saying, as a young person, to have that kind of trauma and overcome it. Most people don't overcome it.
Right.
And that's the thing, you know. I just gave a speech the other night, and because they said, what's your secret of success? I said, I'm not successful, but if I'm going to do something, I believe in it, and I know I can pursue it and try to make it successful. And that's all I've been ever doing. It's all I do every day, try to keep going and keep succeeding. Fortunately, I've been blessed, but I didn't. That's a tough trauma to come over. My God.
Well, yeah, I developed asthma. I spent a couple of years in my room with machinery going, and but you grow up, and
gotta survive.
And you do your best. That's right,
Michael. Whatever happened to those two scumbags?
The two
brothers?
Well, one was shotgunned to death by his wife's boyfriend.
Beautiful.
In a park the next town over. And the one who I think was the ringleader of those guys, he moved to Texas with his daughter and was arrested for raping his own granddaughter, which may have also been his daughter, which is a horrible enough until you realize that his dad, Clint Sr., also died after being caught raping his own granddaughter. So, and I think it was the dad who brought all the sickness into the family. I think we're getting ahead of ourselves.
You, Mike, kid Mike, know the story. Our audience, could you clarify?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
What we're talking about.
You Hollywood guys, kid has done his homework.
You know everybody. You know the neighbors next door. But I mean, I think that's even more important.
Even the dogs, the cats. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, no, I think it's more important letting them know the storyline.
Well, yeah, I'll tell you. For years, the police, I think, worked under the theory that it was a serial killer passing through. And there's an old adage, it's not the outlaws, it's the in-laws. And it turned out to be absolutely true in this case. I found out that Georgianne, my babysitter's sister, had married into a family of brothers, all of whom had rape charges against them. Not all of them were convicted and not all of them went to prison, but all of them had been accused of rape at one time or another in their lives. So they're it's what they do. It's what the brothers do. They go out, they find a victim. And I took the mom of one of the girls who was murdered, Kathy. I put her on TV. She made a request for information. Anybody knows anything, please get in touch with Michael. He's my family investigator. And I got a series of phone calls, all from women in their 50s, who said, when I was 10, these brothers dragged me back into the woods by the creek, and they raped me. They told me if I made a sound, I was dead meat.
And how old were you, Mike, at this
point? I was nine.
No. I mean, when you came into the case to try to solve it.
Oh, this would be 2011.
Oh, so, wow.
Yeah, so it's 40-some years later.
That's amazing.
Yeah, the mom who I was working with was almost 90 at that time. And my mom were both.
I'm trying to do the math. I'm saying, wait a minute, hold it. This is like five decades later.
Right, that's right. And that's why, yeah, the women who were 10 were in their 50s when they were telling me their story. Some of them were telling me the story for the first time. Wow. Because they had never told anyone for 40-some years that they'd been raped. They just, you know, they went home and they cried. They took a bath for 9 hours. They didn't tell anybody. So I had to be very careful about protecting their identities. But I went to the police with this, and police told me that now that I had a suspect, they could compare it with perhaps with DNA. They'd look into it. And they said, well, we have the bathing suits, but we think the DNA is degraded. And this was about 1990 technology they were working on. Only it was 2015 by this time. And so I went to a DNA expert, and I got the lowdown on modern technology. And they said not only was it degraded, but there was so much female blood on the bathing suits that it would overwhelm the male blood. And I found out from my expert, Dr. Gray Amick down in South Carolina, that there's no longer any overwhelming. They can exponentially increase the number of Y, blah, 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 with using the technology. And no more degrading. Get me a swatch out of that bathing suit, and I'll get a DNA read for you. So I go back to the Monroe County Sheriff, and I say, well, we lost the evidence, sorry.
What?
Which I understand is a somewhat common way of responding to what they feel are armchair Sherlock Holmeses.
Right.
Anyway, we didn't get the DNA. Nobody's seen the bathing suits. But in my heart of hearts, I think we figured out what happened. I mean, these guys were doing bad things all that summer, and one time it got out of hand, and it's them. Wow. And they knew no borders. They obviously incest was part of the mix in that family. And they're the bad guys. I don't think
they are bad guys.
They are, yeah.
Whoa.
But they didn't all get the the shotgun.
Well, there one got a shotgun. The other one, I didn't finish the part. Down in Texas, he gets arrested for incest and is sentenced to 75 years in prison. And he lasts 3 weeks.
Hello.
Because
his
fellow inmates, they don't like the short ass.
They put that guy in a barrel every hour on the hour.
Right next to Roselli. Him and Roselli floated.
And as I say in The Devil at Genesee Junction, that's as close to a happy ending as we're going to get.
Wow. I would rather that ending than, doing 100 years in a cell.
Absolutely.
Yeah, well, yeah.
The Lord, he sure does work in mysterious ways.
That's right.
That's unbelievable.
That is crazy. So was it due to your digging back into it that got that kind of reopened the interest to get them?
Well, yeah, I think that there was a time when Kathy's mom and I were the only two people who cared enough to do anything at all.
Sure.
But once she was on TV, we had a lot of help. She's a very sympathetic character. And a lot of people in the neighborhood who would never have talked to a cop in a million years, right, would never, they talked to me. Because I'm Rita Benson's kid. She's that lovely lady, lives down the street.
And
yeah,
you're not wearing a badge.
And I'm not wearing a badge. And yeah, I'm one of them. You know, it was not the nicest section of the world. But we all survived it, and
I'm surprised we haven't seen something like that on 2020 or 48 hours.
Have you tried to do anything with it?
Well, see, they don't like the idea that there's still an assumption to be made about the guilt. I didn't prove these guys did it.
Okay.
I just made it really, really likely that they did it. But from a legal point of view, I mean, I changed their names.
The studios, a network would never touch it.
Right. That's right.
Right.
I was lucky to get it published. It was published as a memoir rather than as a true crime book.
Oh, wow. That's even interesting.
Yeah, the publisher thought the most interesting thing about this case.
They got deep pockets. They're going to get sued.
Right. That's right. Yep. I changed the names of the bad guys, not to protect them because they're scumbags, but to protect their family who cooperated with me. And not all of them, but some of them are nice. Some got the devil gene, some didn't. And I just, it's not fair to them to make part of their public persona that your dad was, your dad is also your husband and also your daughter's father. It's Chinatown, with an extra ickiness added.
I wonder what Thanksgiving is to them.
Oh,
Who do you kiss first? I mean, geez.
Oh, I know there's only one man at the table, that's for sure.
Hello, Jesus, that is weird. I mean, you hear these stories that this really exists, it still exists, unfortunately.
Yeah. And it was going on two houses from me. When the book starts, I'm 9, I think it's paradise. I'm fishing in the creek, I'm running around in the woods, I'm climbing on my corn crib and in my barn, everything's great. And then it all falls apart.
So you said it was on your property or near your property?
Near the property. It was one just on the other side of our property line to the east, and then the bodies were found quite a ways to the west. There were some railroad tracks back there, and they think that the guy might have used the auxiliary road next to the railroad tracks to get to where they dumped the bodies.
Do you have any new books you're working on?
Yes. Yes, thank you.
You're welcome.
The next one coming out is called Moguls. It is about Joseph and Nicholas Skenk, who are probably the least known moguls in Hollywood history, yet at one point they were twice as powerful as the Warner Brothers. Joe ran United Artists and 20th Century Fox with Daryl F. Zanuck, and his brother Nick ran Lowe's Inc., which ran MGM. So he was Louis B. Mayer's boss.
Wow.
So between the two of them.
Right my way home.
And Johnny, your pale Marilyn, has a chapter to herself because Joe Skenk was one of her first benefactors. He had her living in a bungalow behind his house and built a tunnel from the bungalow to his casting room. Anybody could have a casting house. He had a casting room. So she could get to the bungalow and to his casting room without being seen by paparazzi.
Wow, that's amazing. I mean, I got to read that book. I mean, I just tried to watch Blondie, the thing they did on Netflix on her. I had to shut it off.
Mm.
It was the amount. I mean, and the last 5 years of her life I spent with her, but so naive. And I mean, it's amazing how many people. And it's funny because most of the men I know or were like Marlon Brando and different people that I, Tony Curtis, all of them had their way with her because that's all she had to give. And that's how naive she was. That's she thought that was her treasure. You want it, I'll share it with you.
That was her sense of her own value, yeah.
It's a shame, man.
Michael, a couple questions if I can.
Sure, absolutely.
So you've written like over 60 books.
Well, more than that, but well, not all of them are stellar. I wrote Essential Bowling and Slot Machine Strategy.
I think I read that one.
Yeah, that was good. Yeah, they sell that in Vegas.
I was the one. Yeah. So you talked about all these books you've written. I mean, talked about the new one, The Moguls. What's the process like to pick a subject? How does that work for it?
Well, you know, sometimes I come up with the idea myself. Sometimes it's given to me. I got the idea for Gangsters versus Nazis on the golf course while playing golf with my agent. We told everybody we were working. At about the fifth fairway, he says, I just read this article about this judge in New York who teamed up with Meyer Lansky to fight Nazis. You want to write a book about it? I said, sure. The Moguls idea came from New Jersey film director Craig Singer, who grew up on the Jersey Shore with, I think, nephews of the Skanks. They now pronounce their name Shank. They've softened it. But we know it was Skenk back at the time.
But, I mean, a lot of these books, you know, The Moguls, obviously, you know, early 20th century stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you do the research in terms of, I mean, who's alive, who's not alive? You know, a lot of them are gone.
Yeah, for Moguls, I was struggling until I found three issues of Liberty Magazine from 1941, which ran this long interview with Joe Skenk, in which he laid out everything that had happened in his life. They started out, the Skenk brothers, owning Palisades Park Amusement Park.
Wow.
It was on the cliff overlooking Manhattan. And that was their gig. And then Joe went out west, Nick went to Queens, and they sort of bookended the America with their power. So, but I used those three articles as my outline, just as I used the magazine article my agent had read as the outline for Gangsters versus Nazis. That was my starting point. And then I tried to find living relatives. And I found that after a while, they found me. It was kind of interesting. I found out the guys I'd known in college were the grandsons of, you know, Lukey Litsky, who was murdering Spooky. You know, wow. the stories started coming in.
Wow.
And eventually, you know, I realized that I had a little piece of history there that not too many people knew about.
Look, there's a guy I met in Vegas called Joe Skenk. He became
oh, yeah?
Yeah, became a producer with Wayne Newton. Is that weird?
Huh.
And he became partners with Freddie Gallo in New York, who's probably one of the biggest set designers on Broadway today, him and his wife.
Huh.
So I wonder if he's related to him.
I don't know if you remember the actress Marty Stevens. She was Nick Skeng's daughter.
Oh,
she
nice.
She's in a couple. And you know who else is part of the story? Eddie Mannix.
Eddie Mannix
is Nick Skank's man.
He was the fixer.
He was the fixer. That's right.
That's wild. It's amazing.
I love useless knowledge. Supposedly he had Superman murdered. George Reeves. Supposedly.
Yes, sir.
Supposedly.
That's what we hear.
You guys know so much. Was George Reeves gay?
No.
No? Okay.
No. George Reeves was a player.
I knew that, but I mean, there's a couple of players that are bisexual.
Tony
Curtis and like a lot of other guys I know.
Hey, one of my favorite jokes is what this man said. Hey, if you don't like both sexes, you're missing out on half the action.
But the Eddie Mannix, there's a book. I read a book about him and his partner. I forget the guy's name. His sidekick.
Howard Strickling.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, very good. Yeah, and they would fix everything for the studios. You know, with Clark Gable when he killed somebody driving. Yeah, they fixed a lot of stuff.
Clark Gable. Yeah, he had a child with Loretta Young that had to be covered up. I'm surprised they weren't in Marilyn's bedroom with Bobby Kennedy.
Yeah. Could have ended up in a bed somewhere. Who knows? Or in a closet.
Because Marilyn was 20th Century Fox, and that was Joe's.
My God, tell me about it. But when Costello hit her here, you know, Costello hit her in New York, and he found a loophole in our contract. I don't know how people realize this. That's how she got out of the contract, because she had to stay a certain weight. And if she went over the weight, good. And she'd been trying to get out of the contract. She just did Some Like It Hot. She did all these things. And they were just making her a sex symbol. And she wanted to be a thespian. So she came here and stayed at the Waldorf as Costello's guest. And never touched this guy. Him and Loretta, his wife, he was a true husband, loyal. But he just felt sorry for so many people that I met through the years, even Grace Kelly early on. And I used to walk her down to Strasburg School on 15th Street at night and bring her back to the hotel. And that's who I was walking the streets with, Marilyn Monroe, after seeing her 100 times in Some Like It Hot myself. I was like, forget about it.
Well, you'll be pleased to know, Johnny, that Marilyn in my book comes off as a good kid.
She was a good kid, though.
That's, there you go.
No. She really, really was a good person. It's amazing. But we can't thank you enough, because it's funny when you asked him how does he find these stories and how do you get to leads, or maybe it was you, Jeannie. Sometimes it happens at lunch.
That's right.
I know. Well, we're excited to hear what you two are cooking up. That's for sure.
Stay tuned.
You're going to hear
it. It's a secret.
How long do we have to wait?
Well, you want to drive me crazy?
You want to drive me out of my mind that's like, I got to tell you something. And then they're like, I'll tell you later. And then I want to choke people.
Have any of your books been optioned?
Well, Gangsters versus Nazis has been optioned both for scripted and for documentary. I haven't heard about scripted. Documentary is there's ongoing work doing. I made an appearance for a sizzle reel recently to try to get funding for that. Devil to Jesse Junction was optioned. They never made the film. I did a book a long time ago, ghost wrote it actually, called Nightmare in Wichita, and that turned into a CBS TV movie. Against the third episode of Desperate Housewives and the Yankee Red Sox playoff game.
Okay.
So I think seven people watched it.
Yeah.
I was watching the ball game myself. In fact.
Did you get screen credits for it too?
No, because I ghost wrote the book, but I got major points on everything. My agent kept me in the deal.
Oh, good.
So I got a big check from Sony. And that's then I said, well, okay, whatever. They can make a bad movie. I don't care. My name's not on it.
Keep option in the book and make more money.
Hello.
Another 18 months. Good, pay me.
No, it's crazy. But you definitely will be hearing from Michael again on this show for sure.
I hope to be back. And I don't know how long it's going to take for all this stuff to settle out, but it shouldn't be too long.
No.
One or two conversations should do it.
Yep.
And we will keep everyone posted.
Oh, yeah. Oh. Definitely. Well, I want to thank you, Michael, for joining.
Thank you, Johnny.
And it's
a pleasure.
The second time seeing you in my life, and I'm sure it's going to be one of many thousands.
Can I tell you what my idea was? I wanted to come over to your house and watch a movie with you.
I know. We're going to do that.
Okay.
Oh, we definitely have like Godfather viewings.
Exactly.
That's what he wants, to sit and watch the Godfather.
We'll record us watching it. Yeah. And then later on, it'll be a thing.
I'm coming.
Live stream it.
Well, I can't invite you.
If you're coming, I'll fly you up. I'll buy you the airline ticket.
Hey, no fair. If he's coming, I'm coming. I've been around this much longer.
Yeah. I want to hear you say stuff like, that's the one that broke the rib.
There you go.
Oh, yeah.
We all know which one broke the rib.
Hello.
I felt it myself.
All right. Well, thank you for a great show.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Have a great night. Nice meeting you, Mike.
We'll
Jeannie.
Look forward to hearing all the, secret info.
Okay. All right. Keep me posted. Bye-bye. Good night.
Michael. Good night. Thank you.
All right. So that was a great show.
Yeah.
Great guy. And we do have a big future together.
So exciting.
Oh, it is. It is for me, too, because it's so layered, this deal, besides. So with that said, I got good news today also. A documentary that was shot here in my house by Fox, by the same producers that did Get Gotti, if anybody saw that, 3 hours. I did 4 hours here on Frank Costello. And it'll be out in about 60 days. And I'll be promoting that.
Where's it going to be,
On Fox Network.
Oh, great.
Gianni, I'm just looking at your background and it's a little lighter back there. And I was trying to look around the corners, trying to see, it looks beautiful. And I thought one of these days, maybe you'll take me on a little FaceTime tour, because it looks absolutely beautiful.
No, it's Costello's old apartment. I walked in here when I was 13, and it's very spacious on 61st Street. I wouldn't tell you east or west, but that's where I'm at.
I know.
I've always kept it, too. I sent kids to school, and he when he died, he left me 6 apartments. So, I've used them for a good cause, and it's been fun. So with that said, we'll be back next week with some more exciting shows. Oh, in fact, next week we have a mailbag show. So
that's right.
As we always tell you, keep the cards and letters coming. Be a part of the program. Make suggestions. Share. Tell them, Mike, what do they need to do, Mike?
They need to go to YouTube, type in Hollywood Godfather Podcast, subscribe, give us a thumbs up, thumbs down, whatever you want to do. Leave us a comment. It always boosts up the algorithm. Go to HollywoodGodfatherPodcast.com. You'll see the section where you can drop us a question for Jeannie, Johnny, or myself. And, we'll air it on the air. And so that's it. Like I said, get involved. Subscribe. Share, click. Everybody wants to get poked. They want to get shared. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank them. I just thought of something. Last week, I just hit 6 million views.
Yes, congratulations.
That's fantastic.
And we're going to keep on going.
That's right.
You know what's great about you, Gianni? And I'm not going to stroke your ego, but it's true that you are involved in social media. Do you know what I mean? You comment. Oh, yeah. You do everything. You can sit
back. I'm trying to stay with it, I don't know.
You got a job to me. I don't even know what the hell I'm doing. I can't get on this stupid Zoom for 20 minutes.
We're going to get it down.
No, that's great, Johnny, that you do that, because your fans love it.
No, they do. And I, I spend time answering them.
Yes.
That's what's giving me the response.
That's great.
You know what? It is. Not even, I mean, Gianni was very kind to me. Even just this week, reading through some comments on a post I had put, and it just warmed my heart. I'm like, Gianni Russo, the Godfather guy, is commenting on my, you know, on my post. So it's fun, and I know everybody else loves to see. And they're happy to see you and what you're currently doing. So I'm really excited for your things to come.
We're all a part of it. We're going to make it bigger and better constantly.
That's fantastic.
All right. I'm going to say goodnight.
All righty.
And goodnight.
I'm going to say that.
And God bless and stay safe out there.
And that was that. No regrets, no complaints. Lived a life with no restraints. The little kid they all counted out. Proved them all wrong, that's without a doubt. Laying there with my left side numb. 5-year bout with polio, but yes, I won. From standing on corners like how many pens you want to living in a bakery. Then opening my own restaurant. Of course, I had some help along the way. Friends like Frank Costello that I miss each and every day. Things from many years ago still resonate.